Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Good evening. You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting at renegadebroadcasting.com. This is Arcane Semantics, and I'm your host, Richard Kotokevich. The date is November 6th, 2017. I would like to start just by reminding everyone we are completely listener supported. So please do what you can to contribute and help out the station, keep everything going here, just to keep completely free speech alive on Renegade here for our values, and to keep all these great guests, topics, information coming to you. Well, today I have I'm very pleased to say Keith Preston with us. Keith is the chief editor of AttackTheSystem.com and the host of Attack the System, the online podcast series. He's the founder and director of American Revolutionary Vanguard. He's been a contributing editor at AlternativeRight.com and a former instructor of sociology. Keith is also a former regional delegate for the Industrial Workers of the World and a former member of the National Committee of the Workers Solidarity Alliance. Thank you for being with us here tonight, Keith.
Hello, Richard. It's good to be back.
Yes. Well, this is the first time I've had you on this station. We've done a few interviews, but on a different network. I've been doing a show on, but I know you've been on Renegade Broadcasting before. I think when I looked, it was like almost 3 years ago now. But I see, you were on here quite a bit in the past. So how have you been lately? If you could update everyone, all the listeners here on yourself and your work.
Well, as far as where I am now, I just got done speaking at a conference over the weekend. I was at the H.L. Mencken Club conference in Baltimore. Great conference, probably the best attended conference we've had there. That's an academic society for the dissident right. Also, I've got about 6 books out now. They're available through the website, attackthesystem.com, and they're also available on Amazon as well as as well as directly from the publisher, which is Black House Publishing in London. So the website's still active. There's periodically a lot of new material is posted on the website at attackthesystem.com. I'm active on social media, on Facebook. You can follow me on Facebook. And I spoke at the conference of the National Anarchist Movement in Madrid earlier this summer, another great conference. I'd highly recommend checking out the summary of that conference I wrote up that's available on the website as well. So A lot of things have been going on lately.
Great. I definitely had your name come to mind when I was thinking of guests to arrange for my show on this station. As far as what political philosophy, you know, we're always looking for new and innovative perspectives around here. You know, I mean, there's a very strong nationalist sentiment here at Renegade, and you know, you've spoken at a lot of events that have embraced similar themes. So I thought, you know, yeah, you would contribute well. Also, you're having come originally from the left in your political background. Could be interesting for some of our listeners. I mean, even the National Socialists, you know, drew from some of the best principles, you know, from multiple political movements. So, I mean, strategies for political philosophy, I was hoping we could touch on a bit. Now, you know as much as anyone, there's been a lot of resistance to taking anarchists and anarchist movements seriously, which is one of the strong things you advocate. So if first, maybe you'd like to, you know, comment on that to the listeners.
Well, anarchism is a very broad philosophy. I would say that anarchism is a political philosophy, a branch of political philosophy that really has its roots in very ancient political philosophy and some of the early Chinese political philosophers, as well as some of the ancient Greek political philosophers. So we're talking about the Axial Age here, going back 2,500 to 3,000 years. And we see that there's this trajectory that's followed on a historical basis, where you see anarchistic practices and movements developing throughout various pre-modern and traditional or indigenous societies. And then that feeds into the development of prototypes for modern anarchism that came out of the Enlightenment and then crystallizes into formal anarchist movements in the 19th century. And then in the late 20th century, now the early 21st century, anarchist tendencies have continued to proliferate and expand. But one thing that I think makes the anarchist position particularly relevant to the 21st century is the way that the world order is developing. What we see now is a world order that has emerged where we have an international system that is a type of global capitalism. It's actually very similar to what happened in the 19th century, in the sense that in the 19th century, during the Industrial Revolution, we had the growth of the global of a transnational market economy. But it was still regionally contained within the developing nations, like in Europe and North America and places like that. But you started to see huge disparities of wealth developing as well during the era of the Industrial Revolution. And out of that, you came various movements to try to rectify some of that problem. And hence, classical socialism developed during that time. The modern nationalism began to develop during that time because you had a lot of people that were living under these older royal dynasties that wanted an identity of their own in terms of their own nation state or something like that. So that tended to be a unifying force of people with, say, a similar language, like, say, the Italians, the Germans. Even during the French Revolution, you saw the beginnings of these kinds of things. And anarchism developed during that time as well. Now, right now, we're in a similar situation to what happened in the 19th century, because now we see the transition of the modern economy from an industrial economy to a technology-based economy. We're now in the information age. We're now in the age of the cyber revolution, where the basis of the economy is not industrial manufacturing, it's technology and finance. And now, just like you had the growth of the market economy in the 19th century throughout Europe and North America, you now have the expansion of the global economy on a worldwide basis. And that in turn is breaking down the barriers between traditional nation states and things like that. And in a similar way to what happened during the Industrial Revolution, we're starting to see wide class polarizations developing once again. For example, the gap between the rich and the poor in the United States is now the widest that it's ever been since before the Great Depression. The United States actually is developing a very polarized, stratified class system that's very similar to the class system that we traditionally see in Latin America. And on a worldwide basis, we see this as well. The gap is growing between rich and poor countries. And we're starting to see this global super class of super, I guess we could say super mega capitalists or whatever, developing on an international level. And all of this is something that's over and above traditional nations and traditional countries and borders between states and all of these kinds of things. All of those kinds of barriers are being broken down. And we see the rise of this international global super capitalism that operates through the G20, through the IMF and World Bank and World Trade Organization and international financial institutions and all of these different kinds of things like that. And so that's really where we are. But the relevance of anarchism to that is the role of the state, in the sense that as we see this global super capitalism developing, we see the state breaking down on an international level. We're starting to see more and more failed states, more and more regions of the world where stable states have never really been able to take root. We see barriers between established states breaking down. We see, as important as anything, the fact that individuals and groups are transferring their loyalties away from their respective states towards non-state entities. Like, it used to be that in most nations, people held a strong sense of patriotism towards their particular nation. Now that's being transferred towards other forms of identity groups. And that could be anything from religion or political party or ethnic group to something like a street gang or a cult or some kind of hobbyist group or whatever, depending on the person or the group involved. But people now are finding affiliation, finding loyalty, finding identity in groups outside of the state. And that's where I think anarchism in the modern times is the most relevant. It's because just as this global superclass of mega capitalists is developing in a way that was similar to what happened during the Industrial Revolution, we also see the state breaking down at the same time, which is actually the opposite of what happened in the 19th and early 20th century. That was a time when the state was growing, when the state was becoming more centralized, when the state was assuming more and more responsibilities, and when the state was becoming a dominant force in society. Now we certainly see the state as a dominant force in society, but we see trends away from the state in many ways, where we started to see transnational federations. We're starting to see non-governmental organizations play a bigger role and things like that. There's a military scientist named Martin Van Crevel that's actually written about this quite a bit. He wrote a book called The Rise and Decline of the State. That was published back in 1999, but he observed the trends that were developing in the era of globalization, as globalization was starting to develop in the 1990s. And many of these same trends have continued to develop. And likewise, if we look at fourth generation warfare theory, we see the same thing. We see that fourth generation warfare theory, as it's been conceived of by military theorists like Bill Lind and some others, is a form of modern warfare that's developing in a way where war is waged primarily by non-state actors. Like, most wars that have taken place over the last half century have not been between states as they were in World War I or World War II. They've been wars between states and non-state actors. And that's certainly true, for example, in the United States war on terrorism, where it's the United States versus mostly these non-state terrorist organizations like, say, Al-Qaeda or ISIS or whomever. And we see that same trend going on around the world. So I think that in the future, we're going to start seeing more and more of this. We're going to start to see the continued consolidation of power on a global scale. On one hand, continued concentration of wealth on a global scale. On the other hand, we're going to see the increased rise of non-state entities towards which people transfer their loyalties and towards which these organizations actually make war with states and against states on many different occasions.
I do notice now some occasional connections we'll see between ISIS and these Antifa protesters at times. So the funding I'm sure can vary from group to group, but yeah, certainly non-governmental organizations are starting to have a stronger influence than in the recent past in the Western world. I think a lot of us are seeing a decline in the Western world, in Europe and America, of the culture that we had with all this replacement level immigration, and a lot of people, well, first they wanted to put all their faith in Trump. Then now at least more and more people are gradually, seeing that that was perhaps a false hope. As far as getting back to your organization, American Revolutionary Vanguard, it seems to be anti-totalitarianism. I notice you have a 25 points program. Anti-statism. You talk a lot about pan-secessionism, emerging tribalism. I noticed with all the groups you mentioned that could band together, well, you don't mention straight out communism too much, because I mean it does seem to be the mainstay now. Communism, doesn't it? Along with this white genocide that's being promoted through, well, very much the Jewish lobby groups and funding from non-governmental organizations. But I mean, yeah, communism is really the mainstay as far as the format in a lot of these Western countries in America and Europe, wouldn't you say?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because that raises up a lot of really important issues. There's a lot of directions we could take that in. First of all, you mentioned these Antifa groups earlier. What they represent is something that happened again in the 19th century, the early 20th century, where during the era of classical capitalism, you started to see radical groups emerging on the fringe, and the communists were one of them. And the communists were an extreme terroristic revolutionary group, and you had anarchists who fell into the trap of aligning themselves with the communists, thinking that they were on the same side. And as soon as communists started to take power in various countries, it was the anarchists who were the first people who were purged as soon as they were no longer useful idiots. And I see plenty of so-called anarchists making exactly the same mistake today. In these Antifa groups, you'll see people who call themselves anarchists. And they may be sincere in the sense of thinking they're anarchists, but in fact, The Antifa is heavily infiltrated by Maoists, by Trotskyites, and other communists. Most of the leading Antifa groups are communist-led. For example, BAM, By Any Means Necessary, that's the prominent public figure for that group is Yvette Larka. Now, she's just a front woman, but that organization is actually a front for the Workers League, which is a Trotskyite group. Another group is Refuse Fascism. Their front person is Sansara Taylor. That organization is actually a front for the Revolutionary Communist Party, which is a Maoist group. One of the leading Antifa groups is a group called Rose City Antifa in Portland, which is also a Maoist group. There's a New York Antifa group, which is a Marxist organization. In the local area in which I live, there's an Antifa group that I'm told, I don't know them personally, but I'm told is a Maoist organization. So the Antifa is already heavily led and dominated by communists, and you have anarchists that participate in that milieu as well as dupes. And when they're no longer needed as useful idiots, they'll be purged as well. So you see a lot of anarchists falling into that trap. Now, as far as what's going on in the wider society, I would argue that traditional communists really only exist on the margins. What we have now that's starting to become entrenched in institutions in the developed world, primarily in the United States and Canada and the Oceania, Australia, New Zealand, and in Western Europe, what we're starting to see is a rise of a form of totalitarian leftism that I don't consider to be communism per se. I call it totalitarian humanism. And there's some interesting history behind that. But what we have to consider is that in the post-war period, in the 1950s and the 1960s, the left, the far left in the Western world, started to abandon the idea of class struggle, the idea that you achieve socialism or communism or whatever by means of working class struggle. And the reason for that was they felt that the working classes had been bought off by Western consumer society. They were thinking, well, okay, the workers in the Western world can now live a middle-class lifestyle and work eight-hour days and, you know, buy a television and a washing machine and a microwave oven or whatever the latest consumer goods were. And that, therefore, because the workers are living in a post-scarcity society in the Western world, they're not fighting for bread and butter the way they once were. So the workers are no longer a revolutionary force. So the Marxists didn't just abandon Marxism, saying, well, mission accomplished. Instead, what they did was they started looking to other groups that could be the foundation for the kind of radical left-wing struggle they envisioned. And they started looking to racial minorities, immigrants, feminists, homosexuals, students, young people. And out of that came all the stuff that you saw in the 1960s. Like in the 1960s, when you had these cultural upheavals going on and student rebellions and the civil rights movement and all of that, the Marxists started developing the idea that this would be the foundation of the revolution instead. And part of that involved revising Marxist theory to where the focus of the struggle became not economics and social class, but culture and demography. And along with that evolved this thing called privilege theory. Just like it was argued, for example, that just as the working class had been bought off by consumerism and was no longer a revolutionary class, the white working class had been bought off by racism. And consequently, the white working class represented a kind of privileged class that was sort of a labor aristocracy. That's a Maoist term that was started to be applied to the white working class in the first world nations. So all of these kinds of ideas have gradually crept into the mainstream society. I mean, all of this stuff is now taught in academia as, you know, as established fact in social sciences and in fields of that nature. This kind of stuff is now taught as the, you know, as the gospel truth. And what we have seen along the way is that, ironically, the forces of capitalism have co-opted this stuff. Like, what happened is that back in the early 70s, the radical left, after the Vietnam War ended, they went into the Democratic Party and started taking over the apparatus of the Democratic Party. And along the way, the corporate interest and the capitalist interest in the Democratic Party started to realize that if they aligned themselves with the cultural left, that they could recruit the cultural left as allies against the working class, against the labor-oriented left, the unions and all of that. And that's exactly what happened. That's why in the early 1990s, you start to see the Democratic Party taking a far rightward slant stand on most issues. Like, they started moving to the right on economic policy and business policy and trade policy and foreign policy and criminal justice policy. That was during the Bill Clinton era. But they kept moving leftward on social and cultural issues like gay rights and later gay marriage and then later transgender rights and all of that. So that's sort of the deal with the devil that the cultural left has made along the way. They, you know, they're basically saying, well, we'll give our loyalty to capitalism and to the state and to imperialism and all of that. Just give us what we want on our on the cultural and social questions. And the corporate class has been more than happy to accommodate that because they can, you know, the corporate class is, you know, is not conservative. The corporate class is not certainly not traditionalist or reactionary or anything like that. You know, they are cosmopolitan. They are all about open borders. They're all about international free trade. They're, you know, they're all about diversity initiatives and sensitivity training and all of that in the corporate sector as well as in the public sector. So it's important to understand that. It's important to understand that in the today's world, capitalism and the cultural left are allies. Now, what's happened in the process is, you know, talking about communism, where the totalitarian aspect of this comes in is now that the left, the cultural left, has become increasingly entrenched in institutions, most obviously academia, also the media, also sectors of the government, also much of the corporate sector and other established institutions, mainline organized religion, a lot of other things. What's happening is that the cultural left is starting to impose itself on the society through force of law and through institutional domination. For example, the most obvious examples of this stuff that you, this craziness that you see on the college campuses where, the Antifa will go and burn down the campus or whatever if they don't like the fact that some center-right Republican guy was speaking on the campus, and the administration will look the other way. Or you start to see things like people getting fired from their jobs for holding positions that are politically incorrect. Or you start to see all of this kind of stuff creeping into the corporate sector, into the public sector bureaucracy. You even see bits and pieces of this in the military as well. So that's really where we are now. We're in this situation where capitalism and the cultural left are aligned. And the cultural left is now pulling the strings increasingly, and they're creating this kind of new totalitarianism. I call it totalitarian humanism. It's not really totalitarian socialism or communism, because the corporate class doesn't want to have communism. They want to have capitalism. They want to make money and make profits and retain their wealth and things like that. But the self-legitimating ideology of this new global superclass is no longer anything that could be associated with the right wing or traditionalism or anything of that nature, or even national patriotism. It's now this kind of multicultural, cosmopolitan ethos, and that we see being imposed by force. For example, when people get sued because they wouldn't make a gay wedding cake and things like that. All of these kinds of things. You know, there's many, many examples we could point to, but that's what all of that is rooted in.
Yes, the culture certainly lends to the wills of the far left almost as just a matter of course these days in America, and what I've seen in a lot of European countries as well. This immigration issue, too, it varies from country to country how afraid people are to speak out against it even. I hear it's getting pretty bad in the UK, you know, to say anything against the immigration policies. And, it's arguable in a lot of cases that it is a planned replacement sort of a strategy, you know, for the peoples and ultimately the culture. I don't know. Do you see, planned, white genocide and a lot of this excessive immigration into so many, virtually all Western countries?
Well, what's going on with immigration is that you have it's the same thing that's going on with the cultural issues, in the sense that you have this odd alliance between the far left on one hand and capitalism on the other hand. The capitalist class or the corporate class or whatever we want to call it, the business class, wants to have mass immigration because they want to have the labor that generates. They want to have the cheap, low-income labor to do the menial jobs. They want to have the higher-skilled tech workers from India and China and Korea and places like that that are going to ask for lower salaries than what they would pay domestic workers. So that's the main motivation that the corporate class has. They want cheap labor. They want to keep their labor costs low. They want to flood the economy with a surplus of labor that in turn has the effect of lowering the value of labor. This is basic supply and demand here. That's the motivation of the corporate class. Now, on the other end, you have a range of other interests that also are in favor of mass immigration, some for ideological reasons. You know, they think that wouldn't it be wonderful to have all the diversity that they think that mass immigration is going to bring? You also have the parties, the liberal and left political parties in the developed world, have the operate on the assumption that the immigrant populations are going to vote for them and therefore create a permanent constituency for themselves. In fact, there was even a revelation of that a few years ago in Britain, where a former speechwriter for Tony Blair said during Tony Blair's tenure as the Prime Minister of Britain, that the Labour Party decided they wanted to have as much immigration as they could into England in order to make England as more multiculturalism, with the idea that this would create a permanent constituency for the Labour Party and essentially make Britain into a one-party state under the rule of the Labour Party. And the Democratic Party in the United States has a similar goal, because the minority populations, the people of color, predominantly vote for the Democratic Party. So they just assume...
Suddenly we're getting you a little bit staticky and in the background. I don't know if something changed with your distance or the way you're speaking into the mic, but I don't know, it suddenly got a bit hard to hear the last 30 seconds or so there.
Can you hear me now?
It won't be choppy anymore, but it's louder, clearer now. Yes.
Okay. To continue what I was saying, there's a range of interests that benefit enormously from mass immigration. You have organized religion, who views mass immigration as a means of generating new converts and as replacement members for churches that are declining in membership, because membership in organized religion is declining in the Western world. So organized religion tends to be a very pro-immigration force. The public sector bureaucracy is in favor of mass immigration, because that creates more clients for the social services and the educational services, and that increases the job security of the public sector bureaucrats. You have a range of people who are in favor of mass immigration for ethnic self-interest. They want to increase the numbers of their own ethnic group. So there's a huge range of interest groups, that is elite connected interest groups, business, government, ethnic lobbies, political parties, bureaucracies, and so forth, religion, that want to have mass immigration as a means of furthering their own interests. Now, I think that what the elite want is they want an international system that they are in control of. That is, I think the global capitalist superclass wants to do away with borders. They want to have trade relationships across international boundaries. They want to have the large-scale migration of labor, because they want to take advantage of the skilled workers and cheap menial workers and so forth. They want to repopulate various nations with a multicultural population that's in some ways more fractured and difficult.
I'm sorry, Keith. Do you think you could maybe disconnect and reconnect, do a new connection? Because it seems like the station manager is saying that it's still really choppy.
Okay,
I wasn't sure if it was just me or not.
I can do that, yes.
Well, wait, now you're suddenly really clear. I don't know if you just changed something, but...
No, I didn't really change anything. It may be a problem with the internet connection I'm using. That's a possibility.
All right, because right now it sounds great. So
okay. I'll
just try continuing. Maybe we'll be all right.
All right, so the basic point is that mass immigration is an alliance between capitalism and the cultural left, as well as the state, as well as organized religion, as well as a range of other institutions that benefit from replacing the traditional population of various nations and creating a type of cosmopolitan HELOC class, where you have an elite that rules the society, and you have a cosmopolitan underclass that essentially your serfs. A good example of how that works on an international basis is to look at some of the Middle Eastern countries. I really think that's the model class system that a lot of the elites in the Western world want for their own societies. If you look at places like Saudi Arabia, Dubai, some of those countries, the Persian Gulf countries, what you see is that on one hand, you have a very wealthy, very affluent elite that rules those countries. Some of those, the elites in some of those countries are as rich and as well off economically as the elites in the first world countries are. But on the other hand, on the bottom level in countries like, say, Saudi Arabia or some of the other Gulf state countries, you have a lot of imported workers from Asia, you know, from South Asia, from East Asia, from the South Pacific, that, and from other parts of the Middle East, that are essentially slaves. I mean, they're either slaves, either de facto or some cases they're essentially de jure slaves through a type of modern system of peonage or indentured servitude. And already, if you look at the patterns of wealth distribution that we see in the United States today, we see that the gap between the rich and poor is the widest that it's ever been at any point since before the Great Depression, since the 1920s. And in particular, when we look at the wealth distribution, like people were talking about the 1% a few years ago, when we look at the actual wealth distribution patterns in the United States, we see that the poor are barely even on the radar, but the middle class is now not that much better off than the poor. And even a lot of people that are considered rich, that is people who are in there, who have incomes in the low six figures, you know, in that range, even a lot of those are barely above the middle class. But what we see is that the top 2-5% of the population is off the scale, is off the charts in terms of concentration of wealth, and that the top 1% has more wealth than the rest of the population put together. So that is really where we are now in terms of class divisions. And also, if you compare the distribution of wealth in the United States with the distribution of wealth in Latin America, in Mexico, and in the Central and South American countries, what we see is that the United States is increasingly developing a Latin American style class system. And you know, if you've ever been to Latin America, on one hand, you have the opulent upper classes and that live in places like Rio and Sao Paulo in Brazil, or say in Acapulco and places like that in Mexico. But then you have also the very poor, you know, people who are peasants, you know, for whom there's been very little social progress ever in certain places as well. And that's the kind of class system we're developing in the United States. There was a report put out by Joel Kotkin a few years ago. He's something of a social scientist. And he was talking about how in certain parts of the United States, particularly in California now, we're starting to see levels of poverty that rival what you find in sub-Saharan Africa, the poorest nations in the world, places like the Central African Republic, the Congo, and all of that. So the United States is increasingly developing this very two-tiered Latin American, third world model class system. And this is kind of system is being spread on an international basis as well. We're having this concentration of wealth into the hands of a global superclass. Like we have about half of the wealth on an international level is now in the hands of about 150 corporations, you know, your Walmart type corporations that operate on a transnational level. And that's rather astounding to think about when you consider that there are corporations that have more wealth than many countries. There are only about 200 countries worldwide, and then about 150 corporations control about half the world's wealth. So the corporations are now as powerful as individual states are, sometimes more so. And the global financial institutions, of course, oversee all of this. So that's really where we are right now in terms of class relations, in terms of the world economy, in terms of demographic patterns and population migration and cultural evolution or cultural change as well.
Well, there will ultimately be a leveling out of everyone, right? They want to do away with the middle class, have an immense lower class of mixed peoples in all these countries, with just a huge disparity economically between them and the privileged class, if you will.
Yeah, well, places like Brazil or Mexico are a good example, I think, of what the ruling, international ruling class's objectives are. I mean, if you look at Brazil, for example, you see this elite of very wealthy people, and you see this class of, you know, Brazil is a very cosmopolitan society. It's very ethnically mixed. The darker-skinned people tend to be on the bottom layer, socioeconomic layer. And then you have a lot of mixed people as well that are on the bottom layer, as well as a lot of white people also. The elite in Brazil are predominantly white, and the same is true in Mexico. Like you have a white elite, you have a white, as well as a mestizo, which is like a mixed white and indigenous ethnic group that comprises the bulk of the working class. You have the indigenous people that are on the margins. And I think that's more or less the direction that the first world is developing in. Yeah, you'll still have the elite at the top. They'll still be ethnically rather, you know, relatively homogenous, although perhaps, you know, increasingly less so over time. But then you'll see this cosmopolitan lower class or underclass working class that is, you know, increasingly mixed, a mixture of ethnic groups or just mixed people generally in terms of their individual ancestry. I think that's definitely what they have in mind. Yeah.
Well, the climate seems very ripe for change. The more pressure people are put under in their day-to-day lives, the more inconvenient things can be. You know, the more they're open to that sort of change. I think that's what misled too many people to put too much faith in Trump to be against the establishment. And not controlled by it, rather. But, well, we've had a lot of these these attitudes. When we talk about tribalism, national anarchists advocate a decentralized system of tribal enclaves based on the right of all races, ethnicities, and cultural groups to organize and live separately. National anarchists criticize statism of both the left and the right, including classical fascism. But I mean, we don't really see that allowed. In many ways, there are strong double standards. You mentioned something closer to a caste system that's evolving in many of these countries. It reminds me of a lot of sci-fi novels where you have a bred working class. You know, completely separate, you know, from those above.
Well, that's what you find in a lot of older societies. I mean, in a lot of pre-modern societies that were very highly stratified and where you had a very static class system, that's what you found. You found that there was no association between the upper classes or the elite on one hand and the working classes on the other. They were kept completely apart from one another. One thing that's interesting too is automation. Increasingly, the system is relying upon technology to do the work, and that's displacing the working class to an even greater degree. So I think that we'll see more of that in the future as well. We'll see not only more and more cultural displacement and through population migration that's in turn being generated by economic pressures, but also we'll see more and more displacement of the working class simply by technology, by robots, by automation, all of these kinds of things.
Well, yes, we do see a lot of jobs becoming obsolete with the changes, certainly. But the sort of economic conditions, a lot of people project have been getting worse still since 2008 and are certain, you know, we're going to see something worse. We just had information confirmed that 2017 was the worst year on record for the amount of businesses that have closed. I can't recall if that was just, there'll be like the U.S., I believe, you know, statistics. I think that's telling in itself right there. So yeah, I think we could, you know, soon enough, I'll get to a point where, you know, yeah, there could be perhaps a collapse of the establishment. You know, the dollar is starting to have stronger competition from China and Russia's currencies. now. Our manufacturing isn't there anymore. I don't know, with all this immigration, I mean, what happens when everything levels out? You know, I mean, because there isn't much that the U.S. has to offer as it is, as far as Western culture goes for the future.
Well, as far as business closings, what that represents is the fact that economic power is becoming increasingly concentrated to where there's a lot less competition in particular sectors of the economy. You know, the smaller businesses and all of that are going under, just like the working class is going under. So we're moving towards a system more and more where the economy is dominated by these massive transnational corporations. You know, the media is a good example. The media, the mainstream media is dominated by a handful of companies. And increasingly all industries are like that. You know, so these small competitors are going under. Now you do have new companies that become super billionaires, mostly tech companies. You know, like you see like Amazon.com is a good example. You know, the sector of the economy that's growing and expanding are all these tech companies that are producing this new class of billionaires. But smaller businesses, medium-sized businesses, the number of businesses is declining. The position of the working class in terms of wages and buying power and consumption is going down as well. For example, the white working class in the United States is actually in a situation where their life expectancy is actually declining. You know, one of the primary signs of the status of a particular group of people or a group of a social class or a demographic group or just a population generally is what is their life expectancy? And increasingly, we're starting to see certain sectors of the United States where the life expectancy is actually reversing. So that's obviously a serious issue. The economic system that is being developed everywhere really is one where I think they want to have a totally subordinate class of wage workers or wage earners. Now that's subordinate to their respective states or their respective employers. Now, as far as the U.S. dollar, one thing about the United States in terms of its economic system on an international level is that the United States is important to a lot of foreign powers because a lot of foreign powers hold so much of America's national debt. You know, the United States has this $20 trillion national debt, which is held largely by Chinese banks and also to some degree by Russian, by Japanese and by Saudi banks. So I don't think that those powers really want the United States to go under financially. Like I don't think they would allow the United States to become a total basket case, a total wipeout in terms of for economic reasons, because of the fact that they hold so much of the American national debt, because the United States is an important consumer export market for some of those nations, particularly China. And because domestic capitalist interests in the United States are an important source of foreign capital for their own domestic industries, again, especially in China. What we're really dealing with here is a world system. We really have a world system that's going on where when it comes to economics relationships, all of the major powers are essentially aligned with one another. Like if we want to say that we can look at it like this. There's one global system. Right, the global capitalist system, and then it's divided up into different factions. You have this Western faction, which is, say, the United States, England, the EU countries, the NATO countries, and as well as their allies in the Middle East, like Israel and the Saudi Arabia, the Sunni Gulf states generally. And then you have the Eastern Axis, which is like the BRICS countries, like and as well as the Shia bloc, which is in opposition to Saudi Arabia, which is led by Iran and Syria. And then you have the global south, which tends to lean towards the east. Increasingly, the countries of Latin America, South Asia, and Africa are aligning themselves with the BRICS and those countries. So that's the principal division within the global capitalist system. But they all have a stake in the survival of the global capitalist system. You know, just like in the United States, in the domestic United States, you have the domestic capitalist system, but you also have that's divided into the left and right wings of this ruling class. The Republicans tend to represent the more traditional WASP ruling class, that is the old moneyed elites that have all their money based in things like oil and armaments and agriculture and banking. And then you have the Democratic Party tends to be more oriented towards the newly rich that come from outside the traditional elite, which is why you see so much support being given to the Democrats by investment companies and by particularly by technology companies and by media companies and things like that. But it's still all part of the same system. It's still all part of the same system. And then you have, you know, as the culture itself has started to change, you're starting to see conflict being dispersed between, you know, throughout the working to middle class to upper middle class over, you know, gay rights and immigration and gun control and all these different kinds of issues that are out there. But again, all of that is still interconnected into the same system. And it works like that on an international level as well.
And what you were mentioning earlier about businesses having obtained personhood, feudalism—I'm not sure where I got this from, maybe your website or whatever—but feudalism, capitalism, plutocratic elites, corporate personhood, as big government retreats, big business steps in and sucks the benefits of the new technology and wealth upwards.
Yes, well, that's really what we have now, in the sense of we have a type of corporate feudalism. And corporations, these mass corporations that I was discussing earlier, like I mentioned how 150 corporations control half the world's wealth. These mass national and transnational corporations are the new feudal manorial systems. Just like in feudalism, you had these private manorial systems with the feudal lord who controls all the land, and the peasants and slaves and all that are pretty much at his mercy. And that's what modern corporations are becoming. Modern corporations are becoming systems that are, you know, that operate across national boundaries, that are essentially have no political accountability at all, beyond what other corporations can impose on them. And where the workers are essentially increasingly at their mercy. You know, one thing that's happening now, for example, in a lot of the service industry, is that the service industry economy is the largest sector of the American economy. And when I say service industry, I'm talking about retail sales like Walmart and Target and Home Depot and these places, as well as fast food chains, restaurants and bars and nightclubs and, you know, all these kinds of things, clothing stores, any kind of retail, any kind of service, hotels, resorts, things like that. All right. Service industries are the largest sector of the U.S. economy. They also tend to employ large numbers of low-wage workers. And increasingly, they're hiring primarily part-time workers. Like, I talk to people who work places like Walmart or Home Depot or something like that, or restaurant chains. And they say what the trend is that employers will not hire any full-time workers. They'll simply hire a whole bunch of 20-hour-a-week workers. You know, you'll have a Walmart with 200 employees that work 20 hours a week each. That's becoming the norm. And the reason employers are doing that is so they don't have to pay any overtime. They don't have to pay for any benefits. They don't have to pay for any vacation time. They don't have to pay for any health insurance. They don't have to pay for any pensions or IRAs or 401ks or any of that kind of stuff. So really what we're having, again, is we're converting to this corporatized economy with these mass, you know, feudal plantation-like corporations with a whole bunch of 20-hour-a-week, you know, minimum wage workers. We're moving towards the kind of economy where you have to have three part-time jobs to have the equivalent of one full-time job. So that's not a good situation. That is a process of reproletarianizing labor like it was in the 19th century, the early 20th century, where you had these top-hatted big shot capitalists with all the wealth, and then you had the company towns with the monopoly corporations and the impoverished and workers who were barely above slaves. We're not in that kind of condition yet in the United States, but we're going in that direction more than we're going in a positive direction. And so that's really the big issue there. You were mentioning ideas like national anarchism and all of that recently. Talking about anarchist philosophy, I think that in many ways anarchists are among the most forward-thinking political faction, because I think that more than any of the others, they really understand that the state and the capitalist class and the international system, imperialism, all of these things are really intertwined with one another. They're part of the same system. And there's really no going back. There's really no, you know, like one disagreement that I have with a lot of the populist nationalist movements that we see today that are growing up in a lot of different places in European countries and in North America and Australia and in other nations as well, is I think a lot of that is probably a little too backward looking. Like, I don't think that they all get labeled fascists and all that kind of stuff. That's silly. That's not the case at all. But what they actually are more a lot of these populist and nationalist movements that have developed in recent times are really just about turning back the clock to the world as it was before the era of globalization. They want to go back to the world like it was, if they're older, in the 1950s, or they want to go back, if they're younger, maybe like in the 1980s or something like that. They want to go back to this world of largely autonomous nation states that are largely homogenous in a cultural sense, and which are relatively middle class oriented, or at least they have a strong middle class and all of these kinds of things. And I don't really see that happening. I see that as something of the past. I think in the future, we're going to see more and more of what I was just talking about. We're seeing more and more people transferring their loyalties to non-state entities. We'll see states consolidating their position to defend themselves against insurgencies by non-state entities. We'll see people looking outside of states towards all kinds of other non-state movements, causes, cultures, affiliations, ethnic groups, cultural groups, whatever. There was a really interesting study done by some Stanford sociologists about 10 or 15 years ago, when the era of globalization was really starting to accelerate. There was this book called The Struggle for the World. And it was all about how everybody from groups like the Front National in France to rave partiers to terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda to all kinds of other groups were trying to create a new system of identity for themselves.
We'll be back in just a minute.
Jews control money, government, media, and academia. Repeat.
Jews are poor. The government and media are anti-Semitic.
Hola! You've just heard Chosen, one of the oldest languages known to ape. Try another. Mayenta is fat, ugly, and Sephardi.
My wife is beautiful, intelligent, and spiritual.
Good job! We have Chosen learning pods in synagogues, lodges, even selected pizza restaurants. Learn Chosen and stay ahead.
Vaccines are safe. The Holocaust was real.
So fluent, so chosen. Fees, obligations, and genital mutilation apply.
Oh,
You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
And we're back with Keith Preston here today. Sorry, Keith, I should have cut in and warned you so you wouldn't get cut off there. I don't know if you could continue with where you were before the break.
Well, what I was talking about was the fact that while many of the nationalist movements and populist movements that have emerged in more recent times are seem to me to be oriented towards going back to what we had in the past. They're oriented towards turning back the clock. The world as it was, say, in the 1980s or the 1960s or the 1950s when we had these large...
I'm sorry, Keith. It looks like we did still have some music in the back there. I don't know. Maybe there was an ambient track I didn't catch that was still on, but it's gone now. I'm sorry. Continue.
Okay. No problem. Well, as I was saying, I think the problem with the populist and nationalist right that has developed in more recent times is the fact that it seems to me to want to go backward. It wants to turn back the clock to the world as it was before we had globalization. They want to go back to the world of largely homogenous, autonomous nation states with a strong middle class orientation. Now, I think that's a thing of the past. I think that globalization is here to stay. I think that the consensus of elites across the spectrum worldwide is that they want globalization to stay, and they're moving towards this more globalized, integrated international system. And I think that in many ways, the nationalist right or the populist right is swimming against the tides. I mean, they're trying to preserve something that once was but is now dying. Now, the other flip side of that is, well, does that mean that we just accept the status quo? And the argument is no. As I said earlier, one of the most important insights of fourth generation warfare theory is the fact that increasingly people are transferring their loyalties away from conventional states towards non-state entities, and increasingly warfare is changing so that wars are fought not between states, but between states and fourth generation warfare entities, that is non-state military actors. And so the real conflict in the future is going to be between states and the international capitalist ruling class on one hand, and these fourth generation forces on the other hand. And we have people all over the cultural spectrum, all over the political and economic and social spectrum, all over the world, that are creating alternative forms of identity for themselves. The obvious example, the most militant example, would be the Islamic terrorist organizations. I think probably one of the most advanced example of a fourth generation entity that has largely eclipsed a state is Hezbollah. We have the Hezbollah organization in South Lebanon that has essentially become the national defense force of the Lebanese state. And in that regard, it's more powerful and more influential than the Lebanese state. It fulfills many of the roles that traditional state institutions tend to fill as well. That's what's going on. I think that's in many ways going to be the wave of the future. We see something similar going on in the Kurdish territory now, where you have the Kurdish independence movement that's starting to set up its own institutions independently of any of the existing states in the region. And it doesn't have to be something that involves armed insurgency. I think more and more we're going to start to see renegade political organizations of all different types. And that is people who are seeking identity, seeking affiliation, seeking self-determination, seeking liberation through institutions and organizations that exist independently of existing states and which are in opposition to this global capitalist system. And anarchism, I think, is a very far-sighted philosophy in that sense, because it does understand that states are breaking down, that the states that we have are component parts of capitalism, and that non-state actors are probably going to be the wave of the future. Now, where a lot of anarchists have a certain amount of limitation is they're still stuck in some of these old paradigms. Like, you have a lot of anarchists who still seem to think that it's the 1930s and everything's about building labor unions and things like that. I mean, labor organizing in first world countries is going to be extraordinarily difficult in the future, given the transient and mobile nation mobile nature of capitalism. You know, if you have a situation where if a union forms and the corporation will just move that particular operation to another location where there's no union, and they can do that practically overnight if they want, that renders unionization pretty difficult. And so you still have a lot of anarchists that are stuck in that kind of old-fashioned, labor-oriented, syndicalist paradigm. You know, something like that might work in some of the newly industrializing nations, like, say, in Bangladesh or somewhere like that. You also have a lot of other anarchists that are still stuck in the 60s. You know, they're still fixated on race and gender and gay rights and all of these kinds of things. When what they're failing to understand is that all of that is now mainstream. All of that is now status quo. All of that is finding its way into the corporate world, into the state sector, even in the military and institutions like that. You know, that's not on the edge anymore. Those are not fringe causes anymore. That's all mainstream. It's being incorporated into the system. The National Anarchists are a faction that I think gets it more than some of these other groups do, in the sense that they understand that, you know, the global system is one system, and that the real enemies of the system are those who function outside the system, non-state actors and people seeking identity and affiliation outside of state interests. And I think a lot of the other types of anarchists haven't really evolved to that level yet in their thinking. They're still in some of these old paradigms. So that's what I really find the most interesting about the National Anarchists. And you have other types of anarchists who have similar ideas as well. I mean, I've come across other types of anarchists who had some similar ideas. And that's what we do at Attack the System as well. At Attack the System, we're all about strengthening these fourth generation non-state entities, non-state actors, and building alternatives to state systems, you know, promoting all the different types of anarchism and other similar groups as well. You know, we have a very broad, very open-ended paradigm that we use at Attack the System. But I do think that that's where in the long run, in the distant future, that's where the real struggle is going to be.
So I'm starting a lot of groups inside a nation states, almost like something replacing the nation, as a group living within and just grows on its own accord. A lot of people around the station speak about, you know, as much as we do over the internet, you know, it'd be good for places that don't, you know, to have more regular gathering in person. I suppose it builds morale and a community for like-minded people. With all this immigration I mentioned, you know, there are a lot of people at Renegade here who talk about prospects for the future, people who would want to actually see a possibility for the future, say white ethno states in Europe or America. These are groups that could be embraced along with other groups that want to have their own thing as well, in the way you describe a future. But I mean, you know, what sort of I don't know. I mean, right now there's a climate that doesn't have the same for all. If you're against white genocide, you're demonized now, you know. but I don't know. What would you have to say on this topic?
Well, I think that what's going to happen is that in the future we'll start to see groups of different kinds with different kinds of orientations creating their own infrastructure and institutions outside of the state. Like you mentioned, Some people want to have ethnostates. There's other people that want to have income sharing communes. There's other people that want to have religious communities. Like there's a guy that writes for the American Conservative magazine named Raj Dreher. He's always talking about what he calls the Benedict option, which is about more traditional religious communities just forming their own infrastructure and essentially seceding from the existing state. Even within the mainstream system now, we're starting to see people like in California, now that Donald Trump is the president, you know, the people in California object to that. So you have people in California that want the entire state of California to secede from the United States. One thing that I have seen in recent times is that now as much as 40% of the population of the United States either says that states and localities should have the right to secede from the United States, or they would even be sympathetic to that if something like that happened in their own locality. So I think that's a possibility as well. In the future, we'll start to see movements for regional and local secession or autonomy combined with all kinds of efforts to build alternative infrastructure. And the thing is, when it comes to building alternative infrastructure, many different kinds of people can use the same model, even people that don't like each other, hippie-ish, countercultural, leftist, and even, conservative, Christian militia people or whatever, or white ethno-nationalist or black ethno-nationalist. It doesn't even have to be people who have the same beliefs or the same values. Instead, these are models that anybody can use and apply, everything from the Jehovah's Witnesses to Star Trek freaks to environmentalists and animal rights activists. And I think more and more we're actually going to see that in the future. We're going to see people developing alternative infrastructure in a way that is in opposition to, or at least is independent from, existing state systems and corporate systems and things like that. Now, the big question is, what's going to happen when that kind of stuff gets to be so vast and so widespread that the state or the corporate class feels genuinely threatened? I think that's going to be the real crux there, because no ruling class is going to allow itself to be subverted. They may tolerate stuff like that on the margins if they don't really think it's a threat. But when it becomes a threat, I think they will try to shut it down or retaliate. So that's ultimately where the struggle is going to come in. There's a fellow I know in England who has a group called the International Secessionary Movement. And what he wants to do is build an alliance, global alliances of secessionist movements, of regional movements, of independence movements, of anti-system movements that would essentially be kind of like the old anarchist and communist federations that existed in the early 20th century. Only these would be about creating independence from existing states and from the global capitalist system. That could include all kinds of people in terms of culture, in terms of preferred economic arrangements, in terms of race and specific political affiliations, all these kinds of things. But the idea is there's some commonality in terms of opposing this global capitalist system. Back in the 1960s, the early 1960s, there was an effort by some nations, by some third world nations, to form what they called the non-aligned movement. And the non-aligned movement was organized by nations like India and Ghana, and I think Cuba was a part of it, and Marshall Tito's Yugoslavia was involved in it. And they wanted to create an alliance of nations that would be independent of both the American bloc, and NATO, and independent of the Soviet bloc and the Warsaw Pact. Now, you also had, this looked better on paper than what it ever actually achieved in real life practice. But I do think something like that is a prototype for the future, and only in a more radical version, in the sense of forming all sorts of independent movements and resistance movements on a worldwide basis that are doing all kinds of things. I know a guy in Mexico who's setting up an independent anarchist community in Acapulco. I know people who were getting really into the alternative currency thing, Bitcoins and all that kind of stuff. I know the guy who founded the Pirate Party, this network, international network of maverick maverick political parties that are which has actually achieved some real success in Iceland nowadays. So we see all these kinds of things going on all over the world. I know people. I know a fellow, some fellows who started a actually started an a micro nation, their own independent country in Europe called Lieberland, and they actually got official recognition for this. You know, I met the founders of this project once. So more and more, there's these kinds of things I think are going to be spreading. They're going to be proliferating, but they're all ways of subverting the system from the bottom up. You know, rather than thinking we're going to get politicians elected to office and we're going to have a president or a prime minister or whatever who's a good guy who's going to save us all. I don't see that happening. I think a lot of people have really gotten taken for a ride by this Trump thing. You know, I mean, what happened with Trump is interesting, and the same thing happened with Bernie Sanders. I mean, the reason that Bernie Sanders and the reason that Donald Trump were popular candidates is because they were saying a lot of things that people want to hear. I mean, they, with Bernie Sanders, for example, you know, ever since the banking bailout 10 years ago, people have been have really started to wake up in terms of understanding who the enemy is. You know, these global financial institutions. When somebody like Sanders comes along and denounces that, that resonates with a lot of people. Same thing with Donald Trump. People are tired of all this political correctness. People are tired of seeing their own economic livelihood undercut by globalization and by NAFTA and all these kinds of things. So that resonates with what people say as well. Now, you know, the interesting thing about Donald Trump is, to me, Donald Trump is a moderate. I mean, I think it's really silly when I hear the left saying he's a fascist or a Nazi or something like that. That's crazy. I mean, you know, Donald Trump is a moderate Republican. He's like he's a lot like the moderate Republicans we used to have back in the 70s, like Richard Nixon and Nelson Rockefeller and guys like that. But his administration has governed very much like a standard Republican administration. So I think that a lot of people have unfortunately been taken in by some of this kind of stuff. And I don't know that a Bernie Sanders administration would have been much better either. You know, for one thing, Bernie Sanders is very much tied into the military-industrial complex. So I think that's some real issues there as well. So what we need to do, though, is we need to recognize that voting for all these politicians is not going to help really improve the problem. I don't even know that it's going to be a temporary solution. And we need to think about subverting the system and creating whole new systems that are independent of this global capitalist system that's developing. That's really what needs to be defeated in the long run.
Yes, well, it's interesting how you mention it's socially and then and economic and political terms. You know, we can have different systems coexisting. You mentioned the capitalist system we have economically, and yet socially, it's clearly a Marxist system. You know, very much on the campuses as well. You know, I mean, we're seeing meritocracy attacked. Interestingly enough, meritocracy and whiteness get associated often, you know, in claiming things are unfair based on meritocracy and that this is racist. But I mean, you know, the sort of this propaganda we'll see and double standards against white people on in the academic circles is pretty ridiculous these days. And then we'll have the now not just with the job world with affirmative action, but also on the campuses with SATs to get into college now. You know, it's different based on race. You know, there are so many things. I know a lot of the Jewish lobby groups are behind a lot of this anti-white sort of a system, you know, that we have more as the standards. But this attack on meritocracy too at the universities. You've been a professor yourself, so I mean, you have to find it interesting how much effort forces are putting into this sort of rhetoric.
Well, as far as the educational system, there's a lot of things going on there. One thing that's currently happening is that as I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware, particularly your younger ones, as well as the ones who have kids who are college age, tuition and the cost of going to college is really skyrocketing. I mean, it's exploded dramatically. The cost of college have exploded dramatically in the last, I'd say, 10 years or so. And I still teach in a couple of colleges myself. And what I see going on is I see the more and more students taking out these massive student loans in order to pay for, say, 4 years of college. You know, a lot of colleges now, their tuition is $50,000, $55,000 a year, which means that you're going to have to max out on student loans in order to pay for your college education. And you're probably going to have to take out some private loans in addition to the federal government loans. And so you're going to be saddled with a debt of about $200,000 that is has mafia-like interest rates, and which is not dischargeable in personal bankruptcy. So it's really a type of indentured servitude. It's a lifelong debt that you can never get rid of and never pay off. That's what's going to happen with it. That is what's happening with education. But not only is the cost and not only is debt slavery escalating associated with education, but it's also true that the quality of education keeps actually going way down in the in higher education as well as in public education. Like you were talking about SATs, some schools now, some colleges have done away with SATs. They don't even require SATs anymore. And they also are lowering their admission standards on a general level. And one of the reasons they do that is they just want more and more students because they want to collect that student loan money. They want to get as many people in as possible, encourage them to max out on student loans. And that way the colleges and universities generate a much higher revenue from that. And in order to keep all of these people in college, they've had to dumb down the curriculum a bit. You know, like one of the lines of work I'm in, I regularly review academic curriculums that are, you know, college level academic curriculums. And what I'm starting to see is that more and more colleges are simply offering a whole lot of joke classes. I mean, things like, you know, the foundational, the foundations of intersectional queer theory 101, or the aesthetics of hip hop 200. You know, I mean, really ridiculous, farcical classes that anybody, you know, that could get an A or a B in just by showing up. And they do this to, on one hand, appease certain political interests and so forth, but also just to keep students in school because so they can justify having them there and justify collecting tuition money from them. And in order to justify this to students and parents, what they're doing is they're offering students more and more amenities in colleges. Like a lot of colleges now are becoming like a four-year cruise ship vacation where they'll have a state-of-the-art gymnasium and, you know, elaborate sports stadiums, and they'll have dorms that are like townhouses, and, you know, something approaching gourmet food in the cafeteria, and all of these many different kinds of extracurricular activities. Meanwhile, the education itself is being dumbed down to where a lot of undergrad education, even in more serious courses, are now being taught on the high school level. Like I'd say college, undergraduate level college and university education today is really just a glorified high school. And increasingly at the lower levels, like at the freshman and sophomore level, it's becoming almost like middle school, you know, in terms of just the level of or the lack of sophistication that's there. You know, I look at some academic curriculums today for that are intended for, say, college freshmen and sophomores, and I think, well, this is what I was doing in the seventh grade. I mean, this is, you know, this is ridiculous. So increasingly, we're just having this population of dumbed down people, you know, of indebted people that are dumbed down by an educational system that didn't teach them anything. But they entered into debt slavery in order to get this education, and they do this in part because education is largely just a status symbol. It's not even a matter whether you know anything. You have people coming out of college with degrees in basket weaving and Aztec art, and, you know, advanced gender studies and all kinds of obscure esoteric topics. And that of course qualifies them for nothing in terms of getting a job. But at the same time, you'll also have employers who expect new hires to have a college degree just as a sign they went to school. For example, to get a job as a restaurant manager, they might want you to have a college degree, you know, even though having a degree in English has nothing to do with managing a restaurant. So That's really where we're at now with the educational system. And that's really a major part of the dysfunction of the whole system. You're talking about all this stuff that goes on the college campuses, like this social justice warrior stuff. And that's a reflection of the ideology I was talking about earlier. Just like in classical Marxism, you have this idea that there's the working class and then you have the oppressor, capitalist class or bourgeois class or whatever. So you need to have a workers' revolt against the capitalist class. Well, in the modern leftist ideology, they're not so much worried about capitalism as much. They're more worried about just oppression, as they call it, oppression generally. And it's always along very generalized and narrowly construed lines, all white people are oppressing all people of color, or all men are oppressing all women, or all straight people are oppressing all gay people, or all Christians are oppressing all Muslims. These are just very generalized categories that assume that because someone belongs to a particular group, they're either oppressing somebody or they're being victimized, irrespective of their personal circumstances or what they are individually doing. That point of view is certainly dominant in a lot of the university sectors, and it's increasingly finding its way into other institutions as well. It's being co-opted by the actual corporations and incorporated into their paradigm, on a purely cynical basis. I mean, it's just a way of making themselves look like do-gooders and making themselves look like they care about the oppressed, or perhaps they're capitulating to particular political interests that are, have threatened to bring a boycott against them or a lawsuit against them or something like that. Regrettably, I was talking about anarchists earlier. So many anarchists have internalized and absorbed all of this stuff. So nowadays you have anarchists out there working with Antifa and all these other freakazoid groups. But that, I think, is something we really need to move past. I think that, in fact, I if you've looked up my name on the internet, you'll see that I'm widely reviled in the anarchist milieu because I hold to the principle that free association is for everyone. If we're going to have, some of the basic principles of anarchism are decentralized localism, free association, and that implies a plurality, a pluralism of culture and, or we might say true diversity. But to have true diversity, you have to have everybody. You have to have, the right of free association and self-determination for Christian people, for white people, for men. If men want to have the MRA movement or the He-Man Woman Haters Club or whatever, you've got to be able to have all of that. That's what free association is. Free association is the anarchist principle, not this Marxist idea of just promoting demographic conflict for its own sake. And I actually dissent from that that idea that a lot of anarchists, I think, regrettably are so bought into. In this system I promote, we can have free association of Star Wars fans or, rave partiers or vegetarians or animal lovers or Mormons or, whatever, Buddhists or whatever else. But the key, though, is we need to build alternative infrastructure that is in opposition to this whole state and corporate system. We're really are in a situation similar to what happened in the 19th century, where we had the Industrial Revolution going on, which on one hand created an enormous amount of progress in terms of technology and eventually raising living standards and life expectancy and health care and all these kinds of things. But its negative side effect was that it created this huge polarization between social classes. And you also had the growth of this impoverished proletarian class. And out of that situation came all kinds of radical movements and a lot of utopian movements and utopian colonies and stuff like that. And we're kind of in that kind of situation now. Only nowadays, the trend is away from larger states and centralization in government, where very gradually, state systems are breaking down. Power is becoming dispersed. More and more groups are seeking self-determination. Right now, we've got the Catalonians in Spain that want to leave Spain. We saw England leave European Union. We saw that Scotland almost left the United Kingdom. We see movements like that in other countries as well. And we're going to see a lot more of that in the future. Like at the end of World War II, there were 40 independent nations worldwide. Today, there's about 200, and there's going to be a whole lot more in the future. There's going to be more and more communities and groups and organizations and movements and tendencies that are seeking some kind of identity, some kind of affiliation, some kind of self-determination outside of state systems and outside of this global corporate system. It's, you know, Abby Martin, the commentator for, I think she's on TeleServe now, calls it the global corporatocracy, and I think that's really a good term for it. That's really where we are now. It's very similar to what happened in the Industrial Revolution, only now we have this global capitalist plutocracy, and we have all these different people everywhere that are, you know, starting to resist that.
So, yes, like international corporatism is really going to be the biggest stronghold to try to maintain independence from in the future, no matter what your political lifestyle beliefs, differences, which may create all these different groups. But basically, there could be a sort of a barter and trade, communal relationship between a lot of these different secessionist movements. I think is what you're saying. One of the keys might be to maintain independence. You know, if you can trade and get some of your resources from another one of these enclaves rather than the all encompassing corporate state, you know, the better. Even if you don't agree with those beliefs, it's at least a fellow member of a resistance, as it were. I guess it's part of what you're saying.
Yes. I mean, there's no reason why there cannot be mutual support networks that are built up between, you know, Swedish nationalists and Scandinavia and, you know, African indigenous people and Central Africa and, you know, Shia resistance groups in South Lebanon or why there cannot be this kind of mutual support between, say, you know, hippie communes on one hand and you know, Christian survivalist compounds on the other hand. It's all about building up these grassroots or localized, or I guess a better term would be horizontal networks, as opposed to the vertical system that's being opposed from above. That's really, I think, where the wave of the future lies as far as resistance movements. And the great thing about this idea is that you don't have to like the people that you are in mutually supportive of against this common enemy. Instead, you can support each other when it's mutually convenient and go your own way when it's not mutually convenient. So that's, you know, for example, in Oregon now, they've got this movement called Cascadia that wants, it's kind of like a bioregionalist, very environmentalist oriented movement, but they want Cascadia to be independent of the United States. Or in Hawaii, you've got the indigenous people of Hawaii. They want to go back to being a sovereign nation like they once were back in the 19th century. You have people in Puerto Rico who feel the same way. In South Mexico and Chiapas, you've got the Zapatista movement and all of that. And you've got groups like that all over the world. You know, you've got in South Africa, you've got this Orania, which is this kind of Afrikaner community, kind of like a white nationalist community. And in Denmark and Copenhagen, you've got a group called Christiania, which is like a hippie commune that has some degree of autonomy. And then you've got this place in Spain called Marina Lida, which is like an eco-village, almost like an arco-primitivism or something. And then you have all these religious communities of different types, that like the Amish are a good example, that are spread out in this way as well. Or you have the Mormon culture, which has its own cultural I wouldn't say underground, but its own cultural undercurrent. You know, building up all these kinds of networks in a horizontal basis in a way that they perhaps, you know, are interactive with each other in a in an economic sense, or you know, or even a common military defense, or a common common trade routes or something like that. I think it's really the key to subverting the global system. It's not about forming unity of values. It's not about having the same identity, the same ideology, the same culture, the same beliefs about what is moral and what is not moral, and things of that nature. And there's going to be a huge diversity of these kinds of things. You know, you might have communities that practice polygamy or something like that. And you might have others that are very traditional, nuclear family oriented, and some that are very religion oriented, and some that are validly atheist. And yeah, and that's okay. I mean, in this kind of anti-centralist or anti-globalist system, you can do all that.
It does get one thinking as far as a lot of alternatives for the future, other than just something pre-planned, which we have to go along with, which displaces more and more of the masses.
Well, this is something that's happening. You're talking about displacement. That's important to recognize, because this is something that's happening to everybody all over the world. You know, like, for example, people nowadays will talk about how you can go to Vietnam in Saigon, you know, or Ho Chi Minh City, you know, supposedly a communist nation, but you actually see American cultural imperialism taking root even there, where you see kids, Vietnamese kids on the street, mimicking American rap entertainers, or you see a McDonald's with the golden arches in Ho Chi Minh City. And a lot of people all over the world resent the presence of this American cultural imperialism. They see their own culture as being eradicated by this. More and more, you see various industrial interests attacking indigenous people all over the world. I mean, you have indigenous people, native people in Africa, in Latin America, in Central America, in Australia, who are being attacked and run off their traditional lands, and they're trying to run them off of their ancestral homelands. Just like in the more developed country, you're starting to see cultural displacement by means of population migration, and even the population migration that is happening in the first world, like in Europe. You know, we saw the wave of Syrian refugees. Well, what is really causing that? I mean, that's what's causing that is the wars that are being inflicted on the Middle East by the capitalist class of the various various nations. That has the impact of creating these refugee problems. The same thing happened in the United States with Mexico. We didn't have that much immigration from Mexico in the United States prior to two things. Prior to the wars in Central America in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan that produced a whole lot of refugees. And then when Bill Clinton imposed NAFTA, that totally wrecked Mexican agriculture. So you had a lot of Mexicans started coming across the border trying to get agricultural jobs in the United States. So all this was something that was imposed upon other societies that have created all of these crises in the first place. So it's really those at the top of the global capitalist system that are creating all of these problems. They're creating problems with mass migration. They're creating problems with refugees, with war, with people being displaced, you know, population groups being displaced all over the world.
And you've talked a lot in the past about how there's potential to draw from ideals of, well, I hate to use the classic terms of right and left as people know them today, at least, but you mentioned, like, from the rightist libertarian or patriot movements, support for building civil militias to resist creeping domestic and global tyranny. A common law courts supervised by volunteer jurors and private judges, local currencies based on gold or silver, immigration, nationalism, you know, people resisting white genocide, which, you know, a lot here, at Renegade Broadcasting, you know, I mean, we're very, very much, you know, concerned with preserving our people, you know, seeing how many ways white genocide is being imposed, and of course, recognizing Jewish power and how much that does play a role in that. I think I got these notes from one of your sites though about the right and left. Getting back to that, the left, you mentioned some interesting concerns they advocating a labor militancy, affordable health care, reliable consumer information, tenant organizing, abolition of jails and prisons, and then of course appeal to both people commonly to the left and right, promotion of alternative media, tax resistance, the right to bear arms for self-defense, opposition to just the militancy and encroaching totalitarianism. You think it's corporate? I see less and less choices too in the corporate world as the future that they have in store for us. But I definitely like a lot of the philosophies that you suggest as alternatives we can build upon to empower to change the future basically.
Yeah, I think what you're reading from is a manifesto that we wrote up back when we first started American Revolutionary Vanguard, which was like the first group that we had that evolved into Attack the System. And that was actually that I think the document you were just reading from was written about 20 years ago. And that was at the time when we started to see that the world was headed towards this kind of globalized system now that's become even more so and more deeply entrenched in the last 20 years. I think all these ideas apply. I think one real problem that we have in contemporary politics, particularly in the United States, research shows that political divisions in the United States are the widest they have been at any point in American history since the end of the Civil War. This whole thing between the Democrats and the Republicans, the red states and the blue states, and all this back and forth that goes on with that. I think a real problem is that people are getting too addicted to ideology. Ideology addiction is becoming a real problem in the sense that people are grouping off into all of these kinds of sectarian ideological communities that are just totally sealed off and closed off from other points of view. And on one hand, that may be a positive thing in the sense that it's harder for the state and the ruling class to rally the people behind themselves, if there's no unity among the people. On the other hand, though, it also prevents the people from putting up from any kind of united front against the ruling class as well. So we can work both ways. But I think, though, that a lot of people are closing themselves off to ideas that might actually be helpful to them in terms of advancing their own interests. There's no reason to be so rigidly attached to say, oh, I'm on the left or I'm on the right or whatever, that you can't actually hear and understand other people's points of view. If you start listening to other points of view, you might find that there's something of value to them. Let's take some of the economic arguments that go back and forth between, self-proclaimed capitalists and self-proclaimed socialists. On one hand, you'll say, you have libertarians who want to take the free market, the capitalist free market so far that, they want corporations to take over all the rivers and oceans and natural resources and forests and all that kind of stuff. And then you have the Marxists that want to have everything in the hands of the state. Those are both ridiculous, extremist points of view. I mean, we don't need to buy into those kinds of extreme dichotomies. We can look at different philosophies and admire their positive qualities without having to embrace them like it's some kind of cult or something like that. We can look at libertarianism and say, libertarians have a lot of great critiques of the state and state power, and they're good on defending personal freedom, and a lot of them are good on foreign policy and opposing aggressive war. On the other hand, we don't need to turn the whole world into one big giant Walmart parking lot or something like that. And you can see that with the Marxists as well. The Marxists or the socialists might have a lot of interesting insights into how capitalism actually works and problems with corporate exploitation and globalism and all that kind of stuff. On the other hand, we don't really want to buy all their prescriptions either, like having a nationalized, centrally planned economy or something of that nature. Again, we can look at different points of view and take what's good from different points of view and ignore things that might be problematic about different points of view. But it's good to always give the other side a fair hearing. For example, I saw a television interview a few months ago. This was back when the Charlottesville incident happened a few months ago. And not long after that, I saw a television interview. It took place in Columbia, in Charleston, South Carolina. And you had a guy that was some sort of, I don't think he was a white nationalist. He was probably more like a Confederate, neo-Confederate, like a Southern nationalist or Confederate heritage guy, Southern heritage guy. You had him and you had the guy from a black nationalist group actually being interviewed together on television saying, look, we don't want to do things the way they did it in Charlottesville. We don't want violence between the left and right or between blacks and whites or between other groups. We want to find peaceful solutions to some of these conflicts. You know, we want to figure out what we have in common while not necessarily abandoning our own principles. You know, we want to stand up for what we believe and think is right in our own interest. We're going to do that. But that doesn't mean you have to go and, shoot at other people with a flamethrower or run people over with a car and things like that. And I think that's the direction to be headed in. You know, the direction to be headed in is to find out ways in which people who are against the system actually agree, find out ways in which different ideas from different kinds of philosophies might be helpful rather than just sealing yourself off and saying, I'm this and I'll never give that over there any kind of hearing or audience.
Well, yeah, it certainly sounds like a good strategy to fight against the just the state as you mentioned, well, the corporate state. I guess some people have problems with if there are things they really disagree with that these other groups support, just having any affiliation or cooperation with them is just repugnant to some people. I'm curious if anyone does have any opinions or questions for Keith. We have about 10 minutes left. That number, 747-999-6407. 747-999-6407. If anyone has anything to ask Keith. But yeah, we have about 10 minutes left. Wherever you want to take things for the remaining time.
I'm actually curious about your own program and network. I think you pointed out I was on Renegade Broadcasting a few years ago, and if I remember correctly, there was a guy named Dana that I think interviewed me at one point. I think I was on someone else's program. I think I was on a guy named Dion's program. So is this network, is this primarily a Patriot network? Is this a white nationalist network? What's the what are you guys all about?
I mean, very, very much wanting to preserve the white races, and recognizing like the white genocide that occurs in many, many forms, and recognizing the Jewish power that does exist in a lot of the Western cultures currently, and how much it even does contribute to the white genocide, so basically, recognizing, them as a separate race, it goes along with that as well. I know a lot on the alt-right, have different opinions. Many will just consider, the Jews among whites in their version of nationalism. And that's where I guess a lot of disagreements have lied. But at this station, I guess that's would be like the primary difference toward a lot of their philosophies. I don't know. What are your thoughts on Jewish power or, just nationalism and how it applies? It's not anti-Semitic to preserve your people and fight white genocide,
Well, I think all people have the right of self-determination and self-preservation. And I think that, promoting malevolent out-group hostility against anyone is a bad idea. You know, it's, And that includes whites as much as anyone. In fact, I think one of the things that's most problematic about the left in its present form is the fact that the left wants to identify, as I said earlier, entire classes of people as some sort of mortal enemy. I mean, whether it's white people or whether it's Christians or heterosexuals or whatever, this whole model of privilege theory that they buy into, I think is really problematic, because they're ultimately pushing away people that might actually agree with some of their other ideas. So that's certainly a serious problem. And I think that as far as the ethnic composition of the ruling class in the United States, I tend to view it as sort of a hybrid of WASP power, that is the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, the traditional American elite power. And I think that in some ways that has melded with Zionist power. I actually have an essay, it's available online, and it's also been incorporated into some of the books that Troy Southgate has published on Zionism. But I have an essay called Zionism and the Power Elite, where I actually talk about what I think is the actual role of organized Zionism in the American ruling class. So you do have this kind of hybrid, WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant and Jewish ruling class. And then increasingly you're starting to see people from other ethnic and religious backgrounds coming into the American elite as well. Now we have black billionaires, and now we have Catholic billionaires and all of that. So there's some element of that as well. There's actually an interesting, if you're interested in criticizing Zionism, there's a book called The Power of Israel in the United States. This is actually written by a Marxist by the name of James Petras. And this guy's leftist credentials are impeccable. I mean, he's been on the leftist for decades. He's a big supporter of the various left-wing movements in Latin America. But he's got a book called The Power of Israel in the United States, where he talks about the role of the Israel lobby and controlling American foreign policy in the Middle East. One thing he points out is that the ethnic composition of the American elite are about a third Jewish. When we talk about the multimillionaires, the billionaires, the people who own the mass corporations and all that kind of stuff, about a third of that class is Jewish. Probably about two thirds is mostly white Protestant, maybe with some odds and ends from other places. And I think that it's interesting to look back at history and see how capitalism developed way back in the 15, 1600s. I think capitalism was always sort of this kind of hybrid of Jewish and British Protestant, Anglo-Saxon Protestant interest. I mean, capitalism starts to develop around the time of Cromwellian England.
And, Keith, it looks like we have a caller here. Hey, caller, did you have a question for Keith?
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me? Yeah,
I can hear you fine. What's your name?
My name's Jeff.
All right, hello, Jeff. What did you want to ask Keith?
So, I guess Keith is a proponent of an anarchist system of government, or I guess that's kind of a paradox or oxymoron. We can't really use the two in the same sentence, but I guess you get what I'm saying.
Understood. Yes.
So I guess my question is, how can you form like an anarchist community of people with various different belief systems and perspectives in life, and then get them to agree on when it would be appropriate time to resist, I guess, the purpose of this anarchist system of society, which is to resist a government that's overstretched its reach. If you have all these people who disagree or have differing views on what a government should or shouldn't do, or if it's overstretched its power, then I guess, how do you get all these people with these different perspectives to come together in one spirit and, I guess, try to resist?
Well, I don't know that there needs to be an overarching alliance that includes everyone, everywhere, every time as far as resistance movements. I think more likely you'll see alliances forming here and there as necessary against common enemies of the moment. Now, as far as the organizational structures of anarchism, I mean, I'd say the core ideas of anarchism are you want to replace the state with voluntary communities. That is where membership is voluntary. It's people are there because they choose to be, you know, and perhaps if they're born there and want to leave when they get to be of the age of reason, they can also leave if they want. But the idea is decentralization, localization, voluntary association, individual freedom of association, you know, peaceful coexistence among groups with different beliefs and values as much as possible. When that's not possible, people just go their own way and do their own thing. And this idea is not nearly as far-fetched as some people seem to think it is. One model I would point to from history is the ancient Greek system. The ancient Greek political system, you know, the one that produced Plato and Aristotle and all of those guys, was a collection of 1,100 city-states that was spread out through the Mediterranean area, you know, a very large territory. And all of these were autonomous. There was no overarching governmental system. And they had a huge range of diversity among them in terms of their specific political and social structures. We know from the writings of Aristotle that there were at least 158 major models of social organization that existed in these systems. And occasionally they fought with each other and things like that, like the battles between Athens and Sparta, of course. But those tended to be contained among individual cities. They didn't spread out over the whole region. And there was a time when they were threatened with invasion by the Persians, and the city-states were able to temporarily band together to resist this common enemy and the Persian invaders, and the Persians were, in fact, defeated. So now there were, of course, there were features of the ancient Greek system that, you know, modern people wouldn't approve of. For example, they had slaves, you know, the citizenship rights only applied to people of some status and things like that. So it's not that, you know, these were not perfectly anarchistic utopias. I'm not claiming that. But it does provide a working model for the same kind of thing that could certainly be replicated in a modern society. If anything, it would be easier in a modern society because of the communications technology and the ease at which we have transportation technology. If we want to communicate with someone, we just send an email or get on Skype or dial a phone number.
I guess we're out of time.
Okay. Well, I hope I answered the caller's question.
Yeah, that wraps it up. Thank you. All right, thanks. I look forward to next time. Have a good night. And it all sounds the same.
Renegade Broadcasting has a sister site where you can find insightful articles from the past and present, the latest in health and wellness, research, analysis of current events, profound poetry, amazing artwork, lots of videos and podcasts from other content creators, and so much more. We are in a struggle to awaken as many people as possible, put an end to our enslavement in this toxic culture, and create a future where we can be happy, healthy, and free. Go to renegadetribune.com, browse the great content, and do consider joining the crew in publishing your own original work.